Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, one of the concerns I had at first is I had a whole life raising children in the neighborhood and people that I knew so well. Moving to the country, I didn't know how I would make friends.
Christine Taylor tells us the story of a friendship that showed up on her front porch one day. We hear about her life off the grid in rural Ohio. Farmers know that some pests are bad, but others do a lot of good. Dung beetles, for instance, help build soil and cut down on parasites. But now the beetles need help from farmers to survive. A little light juicing with Chef Daniel Orr. He calls it lemonade on steroids. Harvest Public Media takes a look at the booming business of high-tech agriculture startups and a cautionary tale from last year's wet growing season. News stories this week that crossed Mark Chilla's desk.
Fast casual food chain Chipotle made headlines again this week with rumors it plans to scale back some of its new food safety efforts. Just last month, Chipotle announced it was conducting high-resolution DNA-based testing of many ingredients. But now the company may eliminate pathogen testing on some ingredients. Chipotle Communications Director Chris Arnold said in a recent statement, the company is not dialing back food safety efforts, and their commitment to establishing Chipotle as a leader in food safety remains fully intact. Chipotle has recently implemented new programs and procedures to enhance food safety, including some prep in central kitchens and procedural changes in restaurants. Arnold said, quote, "Any changes we may make to our initial plans will be to strengthen what we are doing," end quote. The new food safety measures come in the wake of a series of disease outbreaks at restaurants across the country last year, including two E. coli outbreaks and a norovirus outbreak. Just last week, they had another norovirus scare at a Boston location, sickening several employees and temporarily closing the site. Those disease outbreaks are likely to blame for the company's current financial woes. Chipotle shares dropped 47% from October to January as investors hurried to separate themselves from the struggling chain. Currently, the company's first quarter performance is down 26% from a year ago. Chipotle also announced this week they've hired Kansas University meat science professor James Martson as its new executive director of food safety, a position previously held by a number of officials in the company, according to the Wall Street Journal. Workers at a Midwest meatpacking plant scored a victory for hourly workers at the nation's highest court this week. Harvest Public Media's Sarah Bowden has the story.
The workers say meat company Tyson underpaid them for the time it takes to put on and take off protective clothing required to do their jobs. The Supreme Court ruled the employees could use statistical evidence about the process to prove their case, since Tyson failed to keep accurate working records. Jennifer Zwagerman of Drake University's Agricultural Law Center says this is a thorny issue for dangerous manufacturing jobs like working in a meatpacking plant.
You also see it in the agricultural sector in terms of some livestock operations like hog barns, where it's shower in, shower out facilities.
This ruling preserves the right of plaintiffs to use statistical evidence in future class action lawsuits. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sarah Bowden.
And during a historic visit to Cuba this week, President Barack Obama brought along a coalition of agriculture officials, lobbyists, and industry groups. While there, U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced a slew of industry-funded food research projects between the two countries. With the promise of trade embargoes lifting, companies like Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, and Bunge are eyeing tasty new markets in a country that imports up to 80% of its food. But some food supplies could end up flowing in the other direction. Out of necessity, over the last few decades, Cubans have developed ways to grow lots of small-scale, local organic produce. Some analysts are concerned that an end to the embargo could bring that locally grown food to the U.S. for higher prices. In an interview with Modern Farmer last year, Vilsack seemed enthusiastic about Cuba's potential to export organic food. The idea does not sit well with many Florida farmers, who don't want to compete with subsidized farms and risk diseases or pests from Cuban farms. Janelle Hendren of the Florida Farm Bureau Federation, an organization that represents 144,000 Florida farmers, told told the USA Today that about two-thirds of their members are extremely against the Cuba deal. Read more at eartheats.org and find the conversation about food issues on our Twitter feed, at EarthEats.
That's right. Mark Chilla, thanks for the work.
Not a problem.
U.S. livestock produce a lot of milk and a lot of meat and a lot of manure. But some little-known insects can put that manure to good use. All they want in exchange is some dung for dinner. Harvest Public Media's Jacob Grace with the story.
Okay, there we go. Here we go. Look at quite a few. See them?
It's a muggy spring afternoon in central Missouri, and farmer Ralph Voss is digging through a sloppy patch of cow poop with researcher Wayne Bailey.
Well, there's another one.
Voss has just found some of his farm's unseen workers, dung beetles.
Anaphodius femitarius, very common dung beetle all over the world. Wayne, help me. Quarter of an inch long, maybe?
I wouldn't have noticed the beetle if Voss hadn't pointed it out. It has a shiny black head and a tannish back and seems perfectly content to be crawling through fresh cow feces. This beetle survives, like all dung beetles, by sucking the juices out of fresh dung.
A lady from the University of Texas refers to cow pies as a dung beetle slurpee.
Dung beetles often collect fresh dung and bury it below the ground for their offspring to eat. And that can save farmers like Voss a lot of money. By getting manure in the ground, dung beetles increase grazing area, improve soil nutrients and water absorption, and even reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Most importantly, they prevent parasites and fly larvae from breeding in the dung.
So if you get dung beetles in sufficient numbers to suck all of the juice out of the pie, the fly eggs in that pie are going to perish. It's that simple.
Farmers like Voss have reason to be excited. It's been estimated that dung beetles save U.S. farmers hundreds of millions of dollars a year. But that number could be much larger. Dung beetles have been declining for decades, and it's partially thanks to the very farmers the beetles are helping out. Many farmers treat their livestock with drugs called wormers that kill parasites living in the livestock manure. But these wormers can hurt dung beetles, too. Here's Wayne Bailey, a researcher at the University of Missouri.
You know, I have my own farm that I lease out for cattle, and at this point in time, I can't find any dung beetles on my property because of the wormer they're using.
Bailey is spreading the word about less harmful ways to use wormers, but he also has bigger plans. Most of the dung beetles in the Midwest work too slowly to meet farmers' needs. Hardworking dung beetles in other parts of the U.S. can't survive the Midwest winters.
So we would like to try to build those populations that have adapted to the colder winters to build up in numbers and spread across the state.
That's why Bailey is starting a project to research and breed dung beetle species for Midwest farmers. He thinks that with a little help, dung beetles could join earthworms and honeybees as major contributors to Midwest agriculture.
What we really need is our dung beetle species that fill in the whole season.
Yeah, there has been talk of bringing in a lot of species.
That's Dr. Sean Whipple. He got his PhD studying dung beetles in Nebraska.
It's made a big difference in places like Australia. They brought over a bunch of species from Africa and Europe, North America.
Australia has been introducing exotic dung beetles for decades, where they've been credited with reducing huge fly and pest populations. But Whipple warns that non-native species could potentially drive off native dung beetles and reduce biodiversity.
You want to be careful anytime you bring in a non-native species into a habitat.
Some introductions have already taken place in the southern U.S. Farmer Ralph Voss dreams of seeing dung beetle numbers like those he's seen in Louisiana.
You just cannot believe how many dung beetles there are in southern Louisiana. Enormous numbers. They just devour cow pies. They just destroy them.
Voss is hoping that better dung beetles are on the way and that Midwest farmers like him will soon be getting some free waste management. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob Grace.
This story originally aired last May. Later on today, what's your big idea for a startup? We find out that investors are willing to put big bucks behind new projects in food and ag. Christine Taylor didn't always live like this. She used to have a high-powered, big-city job. She lived in a suburban home. She had an electricity bill and a landline. So much has changed for Christine and her husband Greg in the past 9 years. She calls their situation off the grid. But what that means in the 21st century is probably different than you're imagining.
My name is Christine Taylor, and what I do is difficult to answer. I'm a part-time lawyer, and my husband and I live off the grid, which means that we make all of our own electricity with wind and solar panels. Our farm is in a creek valley, so the sun comes up over the hills on the eastern side of the valley right about 7 o'clock. That's when I wake up and sit up and look out the loft window, and I can see out to the pigeon gazebo and the goat yard and the chicken coop. Between my husband and I, we have 7 children. We were in this big city house with 6 bedrooms and 3 stories tall and basically inside the city of Cincinnati. And we had already bought the 63-acre farm, and we fell in love with the property. It had been like a weekend getaway for us, and we would go out camping and just enjoy it and go fishing and hiking and walking. One weekend, at the end of the weekend, we stopped off at this one porch swing, which is by a beautiful fishing hole. And the sun was setting, and it was lovely, you know, the dappled light through the trees, and it was starting to get chilly. And I don't remember who said it, if it was Greg or I, but one of us said, well, what if we didn't have to go back? And we both just were like, yes, what if we didn't have to go back? Maybe we don't have to go back. Maybe we can make our lives out here. We're high tech. We've got cell phones. We've got a satellite internet. We've got satellite television. We have computers. I think we have all the creature comforts, including a crewing coffee pot, which is very nice. My husband and I always eat breakfast together. We usually turn on the internet and see what's happened over breakfast in the world. Then we put the technology away and put on our work boots and go out and do the animal chores. That takes about half an hour every morning. For 2 years, I did drive back and forth from the country to the city. I would wake up in the morning in our little 388-square-foot cabin and with a wood stove. And for the first year, we actually used an outhouse, and we even showered outside. And I'd put on my lawyer clothes and go downtown to the city. And I just felt so smug, thinking, nobody knows what I've really done this morning. But I knew that I felt special. And then we're always building things. We built a greenhouse this past year. We just finished my husband's shop. And then I have a sugar shed where I keep all my maple syruping and honey equipment. You know, one of the concerns I had at first is I had a whole life raising children in the neighborhood and people that I knew so well. Moving to the country, I didn't know how I would make friends, how I would get to know people. This is when we were still just coming out on the weekends. We came out one weekend and there was a note tacked to the front door. Said, my name is Carl. I've been fishing at this creek my whole life, and I know that it's changed. The property has changed hands. I was hoping I could still have permission to fish here. And he left his phone number. So, of course, I called him, and of course, I said yes. I don't know how he had found it, but he had been fishing there. He told us for about 50 years, this one fishing hole. And when he passed, his son came to us and said, my father so loved this place. Could we leave some of his ashes here? And of course we said yes. So we definitely feel as though Carl is still with us. And then dinner time comes, and we have a deep freeze that's filled with half a side of beef that another person that we know raised. You know, have dinner, and then 8:30, 9 o'clock, I'm pretty much ready to climb back up into the loft and maybe read for a little bit and go to sleep. But I think the biggest thing that people that don't really know us and just have heard about us think that we must live the way people lived back at the turn of the 1900s. You know, we live small. Our world is tiny. Well, our inside world is tiny, but our outside world is huge.
Pictures of Christine Taylor's farm are at eartheats.org. Coming up, tech, startups, and growing food.
there's an increasing realization that the world has limited and in many cases declining natural resources at disposal. So I think that investors and entrepreneurs have started to really sort of wake up to that fact.
We'll hear just how much money is going into drones and robotics on the farm. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. With Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan. Chef Daniel has his high-powered blender ready to go for this recipe. He's big into juices and smoothies these days. This one is how he starts his mornings. It's a bright yellow-orange juice. Much of that vibrant color is thanks to our special ingredient.
Turmeric is something that most people know of as the ingredient in curry that makes it yellow. And it's a rhizome, which is a root. Little knobby kind of finger, kind of looks like one of my fingers, actually. and so here's a piece of ginger, and they're both in the same family. And you can, even in Indiana, grow your own ginger and turmeric. And it's a really fun addition to your inside growing crops. You can put it outside in the summer, and then you have to bring it in inside.
Something to think about for the garden season. All right, have some ginger, lemons, honey, olive oil, and ice on hand. Here we go.
This is something that I drink in the morning. It's super easy. It's a great way to start the day. And it just kind of, you know, out with the old and in with the new kind of thing. So, but that's all good for you. All right, so we're just going to roughly chop this turmeric. And you can see it has this real orange, carroty look to the inside of it. And we're going to also put in a couple slices of ginger. And then we're going to take some whole lemons. Organic lemons are best. And you're going to leave the peel on them. And we're going to put two lemons in this blender. And we've just cut it into about 12 pieces each. And then we're going to add some honey. And this makes it a little bit more palatable. I put about a quarter cup in this. And this will make about 4 glasses. All right. And we're also going to put some olive oil in it. Gives it a richness, almost like a milkshake. All right. And then we're going to add some ice. And we're going to add some water. Okay, and that will just kind of take the water up above the ice. And we're going to put this on our nice blender. Okay, start it low. Crank it up. And we're going to kick it on to super high. Let this run for about, 30 seconds until it's super, super blended and very smooth. So now we've got this nice frothy drink. I like it because it's fresh. It's like a really good lemonade on steroids. Great way to start the day. Get your engine rolling. All right, so here's mud in your eye.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Easy recipe for this at eartheats.org. There are almost 200 food banks in the U.S. that are part of the Feeding America networks. Nationally, those organizations distribute 3 billion plus meals every year. Much of the food comes from the USDA's Emergency Food Assistance Program. Farmers donate food from their fields. Of course, there are food drives where individuals give canned and packaged goods. Then there are people like Phil Christensen, who donate food from their garden. His entire garden, in fact, is dedicated to growing food for his local soup kitchen. But what happens when the garden doesn't produce? This story is from last fall, with Lindsay Wright.
They'll be replacing that pretty soon.
There's a tiller.
I'm with Phil Christensen, and we're in his tool shed. Right now, he's showing me his rototiller. It's pretty important to him because it was his dad's. Before passing away, his dad used the machine for gardening, which is what Phil now does.
The rototiller's been running great for 34, 35 years, so we keep it running. It's good.
But when it comes to growing food, it's about more than your tools. Phil says a successful gardener has to have desire.
Somebody that's willing to get their hands dirty and jeans dirty and a little bit of determination.
Phil started planting in a 30 by 70 foot garden 3 years ago. And currently he donates most of what's produced to the Hobart Food Pantry, just a short 15 or so minute drive from the garden.
Yeah.
You're busy.
It's crazy right now, but this is good though. It's a good busy, good crazy.
Teresa Larimore is the executive director of the pantry. I visited during one of their big annual food drives. At this point in the year, they see lots of non-perishable donations. Teresa says summertime is one of her favorite times. That's when they get fresh produce from people like Phil.
When the fresh things are brought in, not only does it give us nutrition in the best of way, but it also brings in conversation and something that feels special.
Fresh donations like Phil's encourage Teresa to expand the facilities.
We needed something that when someone, say like Phil, was ready to bring us something and it was, say, Friday, but we're not giving out until Tuesday. I needed a place that could stay, you know, in the best kept shape. This took me about a year of grant writing to get this, is our walk-in cooler. So in here...
The Hobart Food Pantry feeds around 140 people every single week, and that's on the low side. So the pantry can't rely on people like Phil because gardeners never know how much harvest will come up. And we all know how Indiana weather can be.
Across central Indiana will be rising across parts of the area as we get more and more rain. Here's the weather.
You're going to deal with a pretty good rain, so make sure those windshield wipers are working.
Record rainfall hit the state during June and July. Some parts of Indiana received more than 8 inches above their average precipitation. As a result, Phil's garden was completely washed out. If you've ever tried to grow your own food, you can probably relate.
They're taking a big risk with the weather. That's out of their control. It's out of my control. It's out of their control. And you learn that, what you've heard over the years can hit you one summer.
Phil lost pretty much everything this season, meaning he wasn't able to donate.
And it hurt me a little bit. And I just had to put it behind me and say, well, we just move on, wait till next year.
Back at Phil's garden, it's a beautiful day. The garden is just dirt, and there's nothing to dig up with the shovel. But one bad year isn't going to stop Phil from growing food.
I get a lot of enjoyment out of just working in the garden, spending time behind the tiller. Yeah, I can come over here and just forget everything for 2 or 3 hours at a time. I know there's a need there, and I'm not providing a whole lot, but what I provide helps somebody.
Oh, and that tiller? He'll drag it out of the shed again in the spring when it's time to plant his seeds. For Earth Eats, I'm Lindsay Wright. A story from late last year, a result of a partnership with Indiana University's Media School. Special thanks to Sarah Neal Estes. See pictures and listen to the story again at eartheats.org. The latest tech startup boom today is not coming from California. It's coming from closer to home. Investment in food and agriculture technology startups reached into the billions in 2015, a huge jump from previous years. So what's going on? Peggy Lowe of Harvest Public Media reports that Big Ag has found big data.
The Western Farm Show is a long way from Silicon Valley. But here in a huge arena set in what used to be the Kansas City stockyards, the high-tech future of agriculture is for sale. The centerpiece at this booth is a yellow and white drone. Its plastic wings span 4 feet across.
So it's got a GPS, so it knows where it's at. Underneath here, underneath the cowling, you'll see an autopilot. It's an onboard computer.
That's Casey Adams, one of the owners of Fly Ag Tech, a brand new company based in Kansas City. But he's not selling the drone. What the company is selling is what is driving the ag tech industry today: data.
If you've got a stressed plant somewhere, it could be a bunch of different things. Too much water, too little water. You need fertilizers, pesticides, whatever. If you don't know where that problem is, and if you don't know what's causing it, it's because you don't have the right information. So all these things are just tools to better diagnose the problem.
Fly AgTech gathers that information by an infrared camera built into the drone, gets an agronomist to analyze it, then offers a prescription for the farmer for better yields. It's making what's called precision agriculture, yes, that's really a thing, even more precise. And that's a big part of the AgTech boom.
We had a segment in our report called, the sky's the limit for drones and robotics.
Louisa Burwood-Taylor is with AgFunder, an online investment platform for investors. It released a report in February that showed investment in food and agriculture technology startups reached $4.6 billion. Yes, that's with a B. In 2015, farmers today already rely on advanced machines like high-tech combines. This is a new revolution, more Silicon Valley style, dependent on data and software.
There's an increasing realization that the world has limited and in many cases declining natural resources at disposal. So I think that investors and entrepreneurs have started to really sort of wake up to that fact that a huge amount of innovation is needed if we're going to feed a growing population.
One of those innovators is Ron LeMay, a managing director at Open Air Equity Partners, a private venture capital firm headed in Kansas City. Open Air has just one ag client in its portfolio, an analytics tech company now headed by LeMay called FarmLink.
We're on track from an ag tech perspective to develop the capabilities that give people insights into how to farm more precisely, farm more productively, develop better products if you're an agribusiness, do better grain pricing, risk management.
Asked for his reaction to the many companies and investors jumping into ag tech.
My reaction basically is hooray. The country needs a lot of funds going into ag tech.
Others in the industry I spoke to called it a chaotic landscape. Small startups are popping up all over. Big companies like Monsanto and Syngenta are getting in. And even tech companies are entering the fray. Last year, Google's venture capital arm dumped $15 million into a network that crunches data on seeds and soil.
An analogy is the wild, wild west. It really is. Everybody's reaching into it right now and trying to figure out how they can help producers out.
Back at the Western Farm Show, Scott Jackman smiles as he describes the industry. He's Casey Adams' partner in Fly Ag Tech. They're at this show to meet farmers who'd be interested in their business, but they're also looking for investors, investors with big pockets who might just be lured into betting on the future of farming. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Several reporters around the country post stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. The writers at Earth Eats are Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, and Taylor Killow. In the kitchen, it's Daniel Orr and his team at Farm Bloomington. And on the digital end of things, Ayabon Binder and Betsy Shepherd. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Hope to catch up with you online between now and next time, eartheats.org and Earth Eats on Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.